Welcome to this week's podcast from Innovation Forum for Friday, 1st of June, with me, Ian Welsh. Coming up, we've got our regular roundup of news and comment and what we're up to at Innovation Forum. As well as that, recently my colleague Toby Webb met with Ashley Allen from Mars in Washington, D.C. Among other things they talked about was Mars's ambitious science-based targets and climate change. We'll hear from Toby and Ashley shortly. Plus, last week I spoke with Jimmy Barsamantoff from Supply Shift on supply chain trends and what best practice looks like. Before that, though, our weekly review of some of what's happening in business and sustainability. This week, a new index of 60 top global food companies worth a combined $300 billion has found that the large majority of suppliers of meat, dairy and fish are still failing to address critical business risks, including greenhouse gas emissions and antibiotics risk. The Collar Fair Protein Producer Index is the world's first comprehensive assessment of how some of the world's biggest suppliers of meat and fish are managing major sustainability risks. Backed by the $3.9 trillion Investor Network Fair, which includes the likes of Aviva Investors and Schroders, the index is designed to improve corporate disclosure. It finds that 73% of the livestock sector is failing to manage climate risk and that no major livestock company uses an internal pricing mechanism for carbon. Given that the sector is responsible for 14.5% of global carbon emissions, the index suggests that the aims of the Paris climate deal are at serious risk. The index also finds that 77% of the livestock sector is failing to adequately manage or disclose on antibiotic use. Abigail Heron from Aviva Investors commented that as much of the food in our plates leads back to the livestock and fisheries sector assessed by the new index, that is why it is of deep concern to investors that a majority of these global food suppliers are failing to manage such significant business risks. Also in climate risks, a paper just published in scientific journal Nature puts some hard numbers on the costs to the global economy and businesses within it of not working towards the climate change limiting targets within the Paris Agreement. The paper says that limiting global warming to 1.5 Celsius above pre-industrial temperatures would save more than $20 trillion compared to a warming of 2 Celsius. To achieve the 1.5 Celsius target, the necessary carbon pollution cuts would cost $300 billion more than the 2 Celsius target, meaning that the benefits in financial terms of the more aggressive, and many scientists argue, essential target of 1.5 Celsius outweigh the costs of a 2 Celsius target by a factor of roughly 70. Seems like what they call a no-brainer. Talking of which, the Washington Post reported last week that the Trump White House had been considering in late 2017 how to deal with the fact that they were working to dismantle programs that had aimed at cutting the US's carbon output, while federal government agencies continued to produce reports that climate change is happening, is man-made, and is a threat to the US and everywhere else. A White House memo that the Washington Post received under a Freedom of Information request questioned whether the Trump administration should have a firm position on climate science and offered some suggestions around formally reviewing the science. In practice, the White House has, of course, largely ignored its own agency's findings, which include last week a report from the US National Park Service detailing the dangers that human-caused sea level rise poses to sites under the service's control. Elsewhere this week, packaging giant Tetra Pak is apparently preparing to fight back against any potential ban on plastic straws and juice cartons it supplies. In a letter to customers, Tetra Pak's head of sales and marketing stated that the company will continue to make the case for plastic straws attached to portion-sized cartons and that their environmental impact is significantly lower than most liquid food packaging alternatives. In some breaking news about a story we've been following at Innovation Forum, human rights defender Andy Hall has just had one of his convictions in Thailand overturned by the Thai Appeals Court, cancelling a suspended custodial sentence and a fine. The court accepted that Hall had not acted unlawfully in his investigations into forced labour at a factory operated by Thai company Natural Fruit. Hall has a separate outstanding civil defamation conviction against Natural Fruit, which is also subject to an appeal. While appeal court verdicts can be further appealed to the Supreme Court, this verdict quashing the previous convictions is welcome news for human rights watchers everywhere. And finally, something to look out for later in the year, Greenpeace is in the process of compiling a report into the main UK grocery chain's use of single-use plastic. Greenpeace has sent the biggest supermarkets a survey asking for detail on plastic use and policy on reduction. No doubt the results will give a clear indication on leaders and laggards. quick reminder that there is still time to register to join our upcoming event on how business can tackle forced labour and modern slavery in New York on June 12th and 13th, where we'll be debating with experts from the likes of Walmart, Barrick Gold, Intel and GE. My colleagues and I will be there and are looking forward to a fascinating couple of days. And of course, we'll be in London on 19th and 20th of June with BASF, Cargill, Novo Nordisk, Mars, CDP, Sancroft and many more for our management conference on measuring the return on investment of corporate sustainability. Time for this week's interviews. Coming up is my conversation with Jimmy Barr-Samantoff from Supply Shift. But firstly, my colleague Toby Webb recently caught up with Mars Climate and Land Senior Manager Ashley Allen.
So we are here in Washington, D.C. at the Nature Conservancy at our conference on how agriculture and innovation can work together with technology to drive better results. And yesterday, Ashley, you did a very interesting session with Glenn Prickett from the Nature Conservancy about Mars's commitments to climate change and how you're delivering results and transforming your agricultural supply chain. So maybe you could just start us off by talking through what we remember of your key points from yesterday.
For Mars, sustainability is a really key priority. It always has been throughout our history. It's part of our founding principles and a major priority of the Mars family. As you know, we're a privately owned company. And our climate change work has really been the latest iteration of that. And so last year, we launched our Sustainable in a Generation plan. And as part of that, we launched a science-based target on climate change to cut our full value chain emissions. So not just what we do within our operations, but also all of our suppliers throughout the value chain, all the way to the farm level, and then all the way the other direction to the consumer, to cut those greenhouse gas emissions by 27% by 2025 and by 67%, so a two-thirds cut by 2050. And that's accompanied by a land goal to keep the land area flat that is used to produce the goods that we source.
Wow, that's quite ambitious, isn't it? So when you're talking to your colleagues about scope 3 emissions, I guess as they call them, when you're going back to the supply chain, how do you get your heads around measuring the impact that you're having there?
Of course, it's our best guess based on the best data available. So we work with a lot of expert groups like the World Resources Institute, the Nature Conservancy, obviously, Qantas, and some others that have done a lot of work to measure the life cycle impact of things like beef and corn and cocoa and soy and things like that. And so we use the measurements that they've produced and then translate them to our value chain and essentially multiply that impact by the amount of those goods that we need to produce our beloved products like M&Ms and Pedigree dog food and things like that.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, you said yesterday it takes 2.3 million hectares to grow 142 Mars ingredients. It doesn't make sense to do life cycle stuff for 142. So you do the most material ones, and then you extrapolate from there. Is that how it works?
We use the life cycle assessments for every possible ingredient that's available within our supply chain. And 142 is just an estimate because really, you know, 142 looks at, for example, corn, but doesn't necessarily break it up between corn syrup and ground corn and things like that. It really just looks at that particular commodity together. So we use what's available for as many ingredients as that information is available, and then we sort of make adjustments or use proxies as we need, but we try to be as explicit and as accurate as possible.
Wow. So has it cost tens of millions to do these analyses for all these different products? I mean, they always used to say that life cycle analysis was incredibly expensive. How does it work for you guys?
Well, actually, we're really lucky because there's many, many companies that are using this data now. So we participate in a group that supports the World Food Life Cycle Analysis Database that many companies are a part of. And the data then goes into that database and companies can then pay to extract that data from that database so that we're all using a consistent and standardized measure for these things, but we're not also all paying for the work to be done completely separately. Now, the caveat to that is where there are sort of special ingredients that we source that aren't already in the database where we can support this analysis, we do. And so we actually support the group that runs that database, Qantas, to do some of the analysis on, I don't have an example in my mind right now, but just some of the ingredients that aren't already part of that package.
Okay, makes sense. A good example of where collaboration, pre-competitive collaboration, the three magic words, have cut costs for everybody, I guess. So you talked yesterday about with GHGs, changing what we buy and using different animal proteins in pet food that might have a lower GHG footprint, for example. Could you tell us a bit more about that? That sounds quite interesting.
Yeah, so the way we look at how we reduce our carbon footprint, what are the levers of influence that we can use in order to reduce that overall footprint is to change where we source an ingredient. So, for example, if we know that a particular oil or something comes from an area where there's high deforestation or where there is low water availability, so high water stress, can we source that ingredient from a different place that doesn't have those same negative impacts? That's one way. The second way, like you said, is changing what we source. So just looking at what within the recipes for our goods, what are the combinations of ingredients and where can we make adjustments there? For example, in the different types of animal protein, you know, we source a lot of beef, pork, chicken, turkey, several different animal proteins for our pet food. And we really are taking a deep look at how can we adjust those combinations or take a look at where the impact is from each of those ingredients and find the right mix so that we're overall reducing our impact on the environment. And then the last thing that we can do and where we're putting a lot of focus is working with others to make sure that these goods are produced in an improved way, in a way that has a lower impact. And so we're working, for example, with cocoa farmers in West Africa to achieve higher yields and produce varieties of cocoa that are more resistant to pests and disease so that supply is more stable. And then it takes them less land to produce that supply, and then they get a better income. So those are just some of the ways that we're looking at how to reduce our carbon footprint.
You also mentioned looking at where you buy, so looking at land use change, and you made reference to deforestation. Are there certain areas of the world that you're thinking about, you know, you might want to avoid in the future because of this deforestation challenge? I'm thinking of things like palm oil. You know, you're kind of wedded to cocoa because it's a core ingredient. It's only grown in a few places around the world. But there are other replacement oils and innovations for things like palm, perhaps eventually. What are your views on how that debate's evolving internally?
Well, it's a priority for us to figure out, first and foremost, can this be done in a better way? Can we work with certain partners to assure that there is less deforestation? Can we work with certifiers, for example, and help better understand their practices for certification, for example, of palm oil and other goods, to make sure that really that impact of reducing deforestation is something that they're tracking in a robust way and is actually translating into results? So that's kind of our first approach. And also, we have a lot of investment in these areas, and we have a longstanding partnerships with many of the producers of these goods. So it makes sense for us to sort of look at those options first of how we can work together to address the problem head on. That said, of course, it's important to us to also look at the areas where that kind of destruction isn't happening and keep that in mind as we continue to grow and look for new areas to source from and as our business grows and we need to source more ingredients.
Okay, thank you. A final question about how you talk to farmers. Mars is a really interesting company, you know, famously incredibly private and then sort of got the sustainability bug. And I heard it was, you know, a couple of family members who were on the board got very excited about it. And obviously as a commodity-driven business, it's become central to your strategy. How do you talk to farmers about how Mars thinks about sustainability and land use and so on? Do you do it on the basis of certification and their sort of technocratic approach? Or do you talk about values of the founders and owners of the company and the fact that sustainability really seems to be a real mission for the company now that seems to transcend money in business?
You're absolutely right. But in fact, I would argue that it's something that has always been a part of our business. It's something that was part of our founding principles, the principle of responsibility, taking responsibility for the impact that we have on people and the planet, and mutuality, making sure that anything that we do that's going to benefit us as a business is also going to benefit the farmers, our customers, consumers, and our suppliers, because we feel that when there's a mutual benefit, that's the kind of benefit that will endure over the long term. So it's always been part of our core values, but maybe we've started to talk about it a bit more as we've taken this sort of next step on our journey to actually announce big, bold sustainability targets. How we talk to farmers, I mean, it really differs and is unique to each different value chain. So in some cases, and I mentioned cocoa earlier, we have much closer relationships with producers because we've been working in certain regions for a number of decades, working to improve conditions, to improve livelihoods, and also to improve supply. And so we have a closer relationship directly with those farmers. And it's all about their well-being, their livelihoods, which ultimately translates into more stable and higher quality supply for us. In other commodities where we're not such a big influencer as we are in cocoa, we work with the various roundtables and trade associations and try to work with them on initiatives that they've already started with farmers to improve practices related to soy production, for example. So it really differs depending on the commodity. And what we really want to do is just make sure in each situation, we figure out what role makes most sense for us to play where we can be most influential to have a positive impact.
Great. Well, Ashley, thank you so much for your time today. And listeners, if you haven't looked at it, I commend to you the Mars Sustainability Plan. What's it called, Ashley? What's the name?
Sustainable In a Generation.
Sustainable In a Generation. I think it really brightened up what was in some cases a slightly dark year last year with all the sort of pressure on FMCG companies and buyouts and so on. Then you guys brought out that strategy and I think it really, really helped kind of give a fillip to the industry and I commend it as a strategy that other companies I think should really take a close look at and try to follow.
Thanks to Toby and Ashley. Last week I spoke with Jamie Barsamantov, Chief Operating Officer at Supply Shift. So, Jamie, Supply Shift works to help companies develop the data points that they need to really understand their supply chains better. And you work across different industries, you're in pulp and paper, you're in food and beverage, and others. Perhaps to start off then, what are the key trends in supply chain engagement that you're seeing right now?
You could broadly put it as everybody wants more information, right? Transparency. Companies want more information at tier one, at sub-tiers. That's just a context and that's not going to change. Within that, I think there's a couple of important trends. One is that for many years, people were saying, let's all do it the same way. And other people were saying, everybody's going to do their own thing differently. And is it possible to standardize? I think the thing that we're seeing is that companies generally want the same information, yet there are differences here and there in what they want and how deep they want to go. And that you can actually harmonize a core data request. And you have to also allow companies to chart their own territory to really get into these problems and understand what information they need to actually solve them, because most of these nuts have not been fully cracked. So that's kind of one big trend, is that we're not going to land on one standard for any of these issues, but that people generally want the same thing. On the other side of it, within companies, I think the biggest trend that I'm seeing is that you can't have silos of data. You have to have all your data in one place. You can't have someone in procurement getting a pat on the back for getting a low price while the other person in quality gets a slap on the wrist for, you know, having products that are low quality, while the person in corporate social responsibility has to now do more to monitor labor conditions because prices have been squeezed, right? These things have to work together and you have to have all the data talking to each other so people can make good decisions. That's another key trend.
How do companies go about establishing that last point then? I mean, traditionally, there's been an awful lot of turf guarding within businesses. What are the processes to get beyond that?
Functionally, it comes down to having the right information in the right place at the right time. That's a prerequisite. You can't overcome the political issues or the kind of the territorial issues if people don't have things in one place. That will just prevent anyone from saying, I can't react to that issue that you're talking about because day to day, I don't see it in front of me. And what is that data we're talking about? There's actually three places this data comes from. First, it comes from companies' internal existing ERP systems, right? Price, quantities purchased, supplier names, product records, et cetera. Then there's the data that they ask for about from their suppliers or audit their suppliers, data that they collect. And the last stream is data that's out there in the world that they might be able to tap into to help answer some of these questions. That's really what we see the smartest companies who use Supply Shift move towards, is adding more and more data streams from more and more sources about more and more topics to then enable their vendor managers and their procurement leaders to make better decisions.
Everyone's saying that supply chains are becoming deeper and more complex, and clearly that's the case. Do you think that companies have lost touch with who their suppliers are?
Saying that they lost touch assumes that at one point they were in good touch with their whole supply chain. And that might have been the case if their supply chain was shorter or smaller. I guess the only problem with what you said is it presumes that there was something this complex that people had good visibility on before. And it's just not true. So we're in kind of uncharted territory. And so I think they need to gain the visibility that they need to understand, is there risk? Is there reputational hazard out there that could cause them some problems down the road? Are they going to be able to meet their goals given who they're working with? They need that kind of engagement and visibility to move forward. I'd say gain the engagement rather than having lost it, because it wasn't probably ever there in the way we're talking about it now.
But do you think that companies have been happy not to have that engagement? Perhaps they're putting the question a different way.
Definitely. That's an issue, right? So the transactional mode is kind of what everything is based on, and it's the requirement for what companies are doing with each other. But if you don't layer on top of that the relational or the engagement, companies aren't going to be able to meet their goals across a broad spectrum of issues, right? Including price and quality. And we find the easiest and most important way to deliver that is through easy ways to give feedback to suppliers on how they're performing on any number of issues, be it deforestation or quality or anything in between.
If you're a company, you wanted to start out in this process, what are the first things that a company should do when approaching a supply chain? What are the key bits of data and the data points they need to look for?
That's actually, I think, has been a core challenge for companies for a long time. And that's actually why we created what we call our Essentials Program. In our Essentials Program, we're partnering with the leading nonprofits, the leading consultancies across a range of issues to provide off-the-shelf a core data request at many levels. It could be the core basic data, the core multi-tier trace to the source data that can off the shelf companies can use for a range of topics, starting at the retail level, right? So we're doing this with the Sustainability Consortium to have that trickle down through the supply chain, and that then creates the opportunity for essentials packages in paper and packaging, essentials package for palm oil, essentials package for apparel. And within those topics, there can be multiple issues that are addressed by a core data request. So we're deploying those in pretty rapid succession now to really resolve the issue of where do I start, right? Companies need the easy way to start, because by and large, what's happened is that the leading companies have put a lot of effort into designing ways to approach these issues, and everybody else needs an easy way to join.
Also important that there are easy wins along the way so they can demonstrate internally the value of undertaking such processes, I would imagine, as well. From a buyer's perspective then, when you're working with buyers, how do you work out the type of information that are important to collect? And also think around how far down the supply chain should you be thinking in terms of traceability?
The session we did at the Innovation Forum in DC was about deforestation, specifically about paper and packaging, right? So within paper and packaging, what are the things that are going to help you most quickly and easily identify risk and potential for deforestation, as well as potentially make you feel comfortably clear of deforestation within certain segments of your supply chain? For that issue, the questions revolve around, is it certified and what country does it come from? And can you provide evidence of legality for areas that are high risk and not certified? With those three pieces of information, you can make a lot of progress to subdividing your spend into different risk levels. And then based on that, then you start providing feedback to those suppliers, helping them understand why you've classified them as high risk, what they would need to know about their supply chains. Those three types of information, some folks say, I need to know that about every entity all the way back to the source. Some people say, let me start with tier one and ask them what they know and then go from there. We have companies doing both of those, and I don't know where that will all head, except to know that more companies want to know more about things further back in their supply chains.
Once you've found the right sort of data, are there sort of efficiencies of in terms of the data collection and analysis process? When do the efficiencies kick in? Because clearly there's an awful lot of data that can be collected about an awful lot of things.
That's why for our essentials packages, we also pre-bake the analytics, right? We say, we know what you want to get out of this. We'll have a dashboard that will just start populating with data as it comes back. That's going to, you know, leapfrog that hurdle. We find a lot of companies come to us with pre-existing surveys, and we say, great, so, you know, question 7 and 8, what did you use that information for? We say, well, actually, we know we didn't get to analyzing that one. And we really think that you should know exactly what the KPI that you're tracking is, that you're going to sum from all the data that you're collecting before you deploy, because that's going to help your suppliers have less fatigue, help you get to the goal more quickly, and not spend time collecting information that you don't need yet. So, you know, that's one efficiency, is really being smart about the data you collect and the analysis. The other efficiency is a pre-existing network, right? SupplyShift has a lot of suppliers in there. There's over 10,000 organizations in the platform now. Over 2 million questions have been answered, right? Every question that's been answered by a supplier can be automatically reused if someone else asks them the same thing. So that helps with efficiencies, right? If a supplier is already in the system, they've already answered a certain question, and you already know that that's an essentials package, well, you know, you've already leapfrogged half of the issues that you might face and all that. The other thing you'll find is that year two is way easier than year one. Once they're in the system, once they have know the drill, updating becomes a lot more efficient, and tracking their progress becomes much more efficient.
So it sounds like you've got an element of pre-competitive collaboration then built into your system. If customers of yours are able to use a data point that's already been logged by a supplier, presumably engaged with a different company, your system allows that, that data to be shared in an efficient manner.
Exactly, right. So we kind of are built for that purpose, right? We're built for the purpose of industry collaboration. For a company saying, you know, I'm going to go with a certain standard, or I'm going to make my question set available to others. SupplyShift puts that in Essentials package in tandem with some partners, and then that network effect is just ready to go. You don't have to build a new system for it. That really overcomes that survey fatigue and that industry collaboration challenge. And then with the other big challenge being that all in one place within the company, right? How do I get all my data in one place within the company to make good decisions? If you can solve both of those at once, which is kind of why we built the SupplyShift network, then I think you can make real progress for company goals and for broader industry transformation.
Let's think a little bit more specifically for suppliers then. We've talked about the fatigue side of things. So what specifically do you do to make the process easier on a supplier? And what sort of value can suppliers get from the process?
So great. Making it easy for suppliers is having a really good system that's user-friendly, with guidance that helps them out, specific to the platform, specific to the survey, all that. We get great feedback. I just heard from a supplier the other day. He said something like, I've been doing these surveys for 20 years. I wish they all used SupplyShift. It was just easy to navigate, right? So you don't want to put roadblocks in front of them. But that's only the first thing. The next thing is you want to deliver them value. You know, they don't want to give you information. They don't know why or what's happening. The best way to give them value is through anonymous benchmarking. If you can compare them to their peer group without them knowing who's who, and learn where they stand on any issue that you've measured, that's value for them, right? They know where they're falling behind and where they're ahead. And if a company and a buyer can do that efficiently, right, then they can deliver that value. If it takes them months to deliver individual supplier reports, that's not gonna work, right? You need a software solution to deliver that added layer of value efficiently. Otherwise, it doesn't happen, and then suppliers are frustrated.
So it's all a question of really just making the process easy for everybody and developing a system that is user-friendly as well. In developing your system, though, I mean, what have been the things that have gone wrong that you've learned the most from?
The complexity of the ways that people ask for information past tier one and the ways that they roll up information past tier one are quite complex and quite different from each other. And to design a platform that holds those different use cases in one platform was really challenging.
Can you give us a sort of a hypothetical example?
Sure. So one example would be that sometimes you have a company who wants each supplier to answer about themselves, to provide their own information. We've had other companies who want the tier above to answer about their suppliers all the way down. So in one instance, someone's replying about themselves. In the other instance, everyone's replying about their own suppliers. That's a different data structure. That's a different flow of requests. It's a different set of guidance. And both of those are valuable. In those two instances, we said that actually makes sense to have you doing it that way and you doing it that way. And the system has to be adapted to make that work.
I'd imagine quite a different type of data when a company's talking about itself and obviously trying to put everything in as positive a light as possible, rather than if a company is being perhaps more critical about someone else that it works with. So I guess having to get the balance and be able to compare that two different types of data sets is quite a challenge.
Exactly. And some information a supplier will only know about themselves and no one will know. And some information their customer will only know about them. In other words, how much of my overall spend came from each of those suppliers, the supplier doesn't know that. So the buyer has to input that information about the supplier by necessity at times as well.
Let's think about the future then. I mean, obviously, this whole area has come along so enormously quickly in the past few years, and things have moved forward in directions that perhaps no one would have foreseen. Having said that, what do you think is the way that this area is going to go in the future? Is it going to be simply, as you said earlier, more and more data, or are we going to get to a point of, well, we can't deal with any more data right now? We need to look at data we've got and analyzing it better. How's things going to go?
What we've enabled companies to do is to act on the data they collect. We have found that most companies spend far too much time in the process of data collection and analysis. And we say, you can automate that. You can make that much more efficient so that you can spend your valuable time addressing the problems that you find. It's not that people won't want more data, and it's not that they can't analyze it now. It's that their time needs to be freed up so they can actually work with their suppliers on the issues they find. And I think we're getting there for sure.
Jamie from SupplyShift, thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure.
Don't forget to sign up for our June Modern Slavery Management and Measurement events in New York and London. We're continuing to work on completing the speaker and panel lineups at some of our autumn event series. If you've got something to say, do get in touch. On October 2nd and 3rd, we'll be in Detroit with our partners, the Herb Institute, to debate corporate sustainability impacts. 16th and 17th of October, we'll be in Amsterdam for our next event on sustainable plastics. And the 6th and 7th of November, we'll be holding our Sustainable Landscapes Conference in London. That's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and we'll be back next week.